Well, let me see if I actually shout. I've learned that I actually speak backward, so I'm cracking my brain because my voice is going back, but out in front, everybody says, I can't hear you. So is that better, Katie?
Yes.
So if I talk like this, maybe I don't need a mic. And then in back, if I'm mumbling, throw up your hand. Because we've heard some wonderful lectures here in Vespers last night, and the lectures on the Chartres Cathedral about how beauty is actually truth. Tonight, I'm going to try to give in about 30 minutes the fundamentals of geology that I think every educated person should actually know. Now, these are sort of the tools. I think it's similar if we took painting. We're now talking about brushes and the canvas and the mechanics that you use to make a painting. And to know a little something about that, I hope doesn't destroy looking at a Van Gogh painting. And similarly in music, if you learn how to tune a violin, I hope that doesn't destroy the beauty of listening to a violin. So now we're going to take 30 minutes to go over on this first page what I think is the essentials of modern geology. I think that's okay, Joel. Let's forget it. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm going to show on the slides the things that are on the paper. And in the upper left-hand corner of the sheet, you see an Apollo 17 image of the Earth. And on the slide, you see one from Apollo 10. You see how much better the resolution is, and you can pick out Greenland and the U.S. But what I'm showing this for is that we're all convinced in our day and age that the planets are spheres. And they are very nearly perfect spheres, except not quite. Now, this is because this material that we have in the solid Earth was once totally molten. And a liquid has its outer surface, even when it's in a gravitational field. And raindrops are not spheres because they are falling and they're made streamlined by the air interfacing against the outer membrane of the liquid. A unique thing about the liquid state of matter is that it forms its own surface. And so we have to accept the fact that the Earth was once molten. I don't know how many were here for my earlier lecture, but it's in Genesis that there were waters and the land appeared and rose out of the water. So accepting the fact that the Earth was a sphere, it makes a difference how hot things are. Now, hot is a measurable phenomenon. You can do it by touching things, or you can put a liquid in a glass tube, and as the liquid expands, it moves up and you have a thermometer. You have to decide what you're going to use for the measurements. It's a similar thing that I talked about the other night about time. You have to have a standard for time. You can use a day or a second. Well, with water, when you have the steam and the water together, it's found that if you're at the atmospheric pressure of the Earth, atmosphere pressing down on this system, that will always be the same temperature. It'll be the same temperature whether you have a kettle of water on your stove or whether you have hot springs.
Water.
Speaking of water.
Oh, yeah.
So the quantity of the system, water and steam, is irrelevant with regard to measuring something that we call temperatures. Similarly, when you have water and ice, whether you have a little or a lot, you will have a specific temperature if you specify the pressure of the system that you're dealing with. So with that in mind, we can now turn to looking at the Earth and beginning to interpret data about it. And the lower slide, when there is a disturbance in the Earth, when you have the solid Earth and there are pressures within it that are causing two segments of the Earth to move relative to another segment, frequently the motion, because these are actually attached, does not begin until you have more pressure than you need to move it. And once you exceed that, the movement will occur. I should have brought a stick with me. If you take a stick, you slowly bend it, you'll reach a point where the pressure on these two pieces, which are moving in two different directions, it'll snap. That snap we see in the Earth, and we get evidence from it from earthquakes. And when they occur, a pressure wave is sent out through a solid. And my voice, for example, is impinging on your eardrums in a faint way because in speaking, I'm moving the air in front of me. It's moving in a wave, and it's hitting your eardrum, and you're picking up the sound. The earthquake waves are the same, and there are several different kinds. The principal one is called the P wave, also conveniently the primary wave. It's the one that arrives first at any location. Now, it's hard to think of things in three dimensions, but we know the Earth is a sphere. But we can look at a slice of it, and this is the path of an earthquake wave occurring at this point and sensed over here after a certain amount of time. It's not a straight line because the pressure wave travels at a different rate through different materials. Travels much slower through air than water, faster through rock, and at different rates through different kinds of rock. Same phenomenon with light. If you put a pencil in a glass of water, it doesn't look straight. It's bent because the light is traveling at a different velocity through the water. So it's a curved line. Now, I'm showing three regions of the Earth, which have been defined not by our sampling them, but by the evidence that we get from earthquakes. And the same earthquake will send out a wave that goes directly through the Earth. It will not be bent or refracted, is the word, the technical word. It comes straight through, but it comes at different rates through these different materials. And similarly, one that is in this direction will be refracted. If there is a layer in here, it will be bent differently than this, and so it comes out at a different point. And this defines a shadow in which you do not get any pressure waves from an earthquake, and it tells you about the diameter of this material here. And this wave is actually defining a solid that is in the interior of the Earth. And we might think that the entire Earth is solid if it were not for the secondary wave, the one that comes after the pressure wave, which is a shear wave. The things are moving this way rather than like this. And the shear wave will not go through a liquid. So it turns out, it was discovered in the early part of the 20th century, there is a shadow for the S waves. And that means that there has to be a volume inside the Earth, and you can measure its diameter by this, that is actually liquid. So let's use, for brevity the rest of the evening, melt rather than liquid. Think of liquid as a water. Melt is a silicate liquid, and it has to be at thousands of degrees temperature in order to be a liquid. So we have a liquid there, and we have a solid in the middle, defined by the earthquake waves. And because of that, we can make a computer image. The exterior of that sphere on the right is actually satellite imagery. The interior is a computerized model, not of an artist's imagination. It is based on more and more subtle interpretation of this kind of data. And the first one to look at it globally was a Yugoslav by the name of Moho Ravicic. And the first layer that he found was something beneath the ocean floors at about 7 miles, and it's called the Moho discontinuity. It's a fine detail way out here. Since then, those, you see the yellow around the interior solid sphere, shows that it is erupting in various forms going up to the surface of the Earth. Now, when I started in geology in 1958, at the age of 32, the idea that molten material could be coming from deep in the Earth was considered a ridiculous idea. There was no information that told you, it just seemed ridiculous. Now we actually have physical evidence from the earthquake data that there's some dispute. Either the heat of the melt around that sphere is causing material around it to melt. When things melt, they have a larger volume per unit mass compared to the solid. Except for one important part of the Earth. I don't like this when lecturers say, now tell me, what is that? If I know it, I'll tell you, and if you know it, you can say, why is it? We all know that. Well, ice floats on water. Ice is a solid. If ice had a greater ratio of mass to volume, which is density, it would sink, like everything else in the Earth does. That's why this ball is in the center, because it has a mass to volume ratio called the density, 10 times that of ice. And so it sinks to the center under the force of gravity. We'd have a very different world. Yes?
Where on that, to where do we feel the earthquake?
Right here.
No, over there.
Over there. Well, let's say that this is Tokyo.
Yeah.
And that's where the earthquake occurs.
That's where the break occurs. Or the
that's
shift.
Where the break occurred. Let's say this is Hulen Village.
Okay.
That's where you'd feel it.
So Tokyo would not feel it.
They certainly would. And the closer you are, the more you're going to feel.
Yeah, but what about this thing? Why would we feel it in Hulen Village then?
Well, because, a good reason, take a bell, hit a bell,
yeah.
And why do you hear it off in the distance,
okay.
And why do you hear
I
it
see.
Here?
I see.
It's
okay.
Again this pressure wave.
Okay, got it.
Yeah. And even they can even possibly hear me over there, even though I'm speaking toward
got
you,
okay.
Because the air is moving.
So the main break, you'll feel it most intensely, but then there is this wave that hits.
Further away, the more Several it is.
Okay.
That's a good question. That's the kind of questions we need to keep on track here. Otherwise, this just becomes a lot of diagrams. But in any event, that up there is an actual image based on what we now know about molten material coming to the surface of the Earth. And we're surrounded by volcanic mountains, and you've all lived through the Mount St. Helens episode. We think we know where the molten material that's now deep in Mount St. Helens that is cooling. That material at one time was coming from the center, near the center of the Earth. Okay, well, on the upper left is a section of a plane, and it's our transition to the next thing that we can say about the Earth, that we have about a 100-mile thick layer defined by the earthquake data that we didn't know about until after the 1960s. And before that, we have the Mohorovicic discontinuity, which we called the crust. Everything below it we called the mantle, because we knew about the liquid core, we knew about the solid. So we just, this great unknown volume, the mantle is what covered the interior, and it was covered over by crust. Very much like an apple pie with crust, and then the pie, and then if you made a mistake and all the apples sink to the bottom, the center of the Earth. We now know that there are these plates. There's an outer plate about 100 kilometers thick that's recognizable by the earthquake data. And we know that, not shown, well, it does show a plume from the outer core, that there are these plumes that are working their way through this material. And we know now, I've put the chemistry on here, that there's an iron nickel core. And already shown in this diagram are two other features. One is called a mid-ocean ridge, where it suggests that a plate is broken and it's moving apart. And at the other side, strange term called subduction, where it is shown that a plate is hitting another plate and returning back into the mantle. So that's all based now on earthquake data. And this just reviews that we can actually put numbers on something like water. If you have atmospheric pressure at 0 degree, we call it 0 degrees centigrade, when you have water, ice, and steam all coexisting. And at 100 degrees, we have at 1 atmosphere pressure, if you draw that line up, we have water and steam, the common phenomenon that you figure when you're sweating over a stove, or when you go to an exercise parlor, or when you actually do some work. And there is a temperature, 270 degrees, 73 degrees centigrade, where it doesn't make any difference what the pressure is. You cannot tell steam from liquid. Everything is now a gas or steam. The important part of this is that the boundary between water and ice has what we call a negative slope. So what happens when you take a block of ice, lay a string across it with two weights on either side of the string? You'll find that the string makes its way through the block of ice. And it'll go all the way through, but the ice refreezes above the string. And you can see from this diagram, and now here's where, I don't know whether there's any beauty in this, but there's certain satisfaction that a thing that just has numbers and lines can show you this beautiful thing, that if you move upward from that E, you're in the field of ice. You move upward and you come into the field of water. And that is why ice floats on water. We lower the pressure and the ice converts, increase the pressure and we convert ice to water. And if we lower the pressure, we go back into the ice. So that's why the stream.
So if I was in Minnesota and it was 32 degrees,
right,
I had a block of ice, I'd lay the string with weights on either side of my block of ice, and the pressure from the weighted string is going to slide through the block.
Right. You don't have to saw it.
The pressure changes the temperature, changes ice into water.
Yeah.
And as soon as that pressure is passed, it'll refreeze.
Yeah.
Got it. That's interesting.
Yeah, you know, it's worth pausing a moment just to reflect on that. In general, we don't think of things like that. Now, what if you take a big steel saw? The reason that on either side of the saw it doesn't refreeze is because you actually separate it and there's air in there and you can't join the ice together. And it also teaches you something about patience. You don't have to frantically sit there and rub this saw back and forth. You could let it sit there and go read a book. Why didn't you tell me to do that, Katie? It's not because you're all too young. I'm 81 years old, but so I know about going out in the pond and cutting ice to have for the summer. Well,
it's also fortunate because if it was the other way around, all the lakes in Minnesota and Wisconsin would freeze from the bottom up and it wouldn't be efficient.
Yeah, and you would have to have spontaneous regeneration of every creepy, crawly thing that's in the lake. Yeah. Well, now one of the unusual things is that you can go in a laboratory and you can melt copper and you can let it solidify. And you can make a diagram similar to the one we made for water. You can have copper as a gas if you really get things hot enough. And however, when you plot the data, you find that instead of like this, the division between the solid and the melt is the other direction. So what happens now when you lower the pressure of rock? Now, this is just all solids combined in various ways. If we separate them out and we put numbers on it, there will be different numbers for different things. But for average rock, we can actually get a number. Now, instead of using melt, which we use to refer to things in the laboratory, when we're talking about large-scale volumes of rock melt, geologists have come to call that magma, which means the molten, large amount of molten material. And so if you lower the pressure on the mantle of the Earth, you will get a liquid. So if we went back to our diagram where we have the plates, if the plate is solid, it's like the lid on a tea kettle, and there'll be tremendous pressure under here, pressure of everything weighing down on it. What if we crack it? If we crack it, the pressure is lower, same as the string. Now the opposite happens with rock. The rock becomes molten. It is less dense than what it came from, and so it floats up. this is one of the things that solved a great problem in geology of how do you get materials to feed something like the Mount St. Helens volcano. It's simple, and you think, how can that be that I just lower the pressure and all of a sudden something is liquid? Because in general, you think in order to melt something, you have to heat it. The details of the Earth, it was thought that you had to get a lot of radioactive elements concentrated somewhere beneath Mount St. Helens, and they would, the radioactive decay would generate molten material and it would float up. It would actually break the rock to make its way up. And lo and behold, when the interpretation of the earthquake data was available, we realized that there was a much simpler explanation for volcanism, and that is simply the reduction of pressure. So we can move on. This just shows that again. Now, this is a topographic view of the Earth with the deepest parts of the Earth blue and the going toward the reds for high elevations. And the deepest part of the Earth is in a trench where a plate is going down off the Philippines called the Marianas Trench. And the highest place on Earth is the little red spot of the Himalayas. And I've got to figure out why they're making Antarctica and Greenland that red, because they're not as high as the Himalayas. So that's the surface. Now, from the geology, it is found that the data on, you were asking where earthquakes occur, you can determine where they occur, and wherever there are these black lines, that's where the earthquake data is concentrated. Not all the earthquakes occur there, but the major ones. So the Earth is like an egg where you've broken the shell. So there's a whole series of what are called plates. And so I let that sink in, that there's this 100-mile thick layer, and then there are about 4,000 miles before you get to the interior of the Earth. So 100 miles is kind of like an eggshell relative to the total diameter of an egg. So it's a thin thing, and it's broken. Now, if you have broken pieces in the sphere, you can think in your own mind, without even making observations, how many ways can you move these different fragments? Well, one of the first ones that occurs to one is you can move two fragments away from each other. That's one motion. You can move them together. If you do that, and you on a sphere, you have to push one under the other. Whereas when you're pulling them apart, you can just pull them apart. Now, that creates an interesting thing. If the egg is not getting bigger, in some places you're pulling the shell apart, other places you've got to be pushing it back together. And there's a whole community of earth scientists called geophysicists who are spending their careers adding up the motions of these plates to see actually whether it does all add up. It's just like balancing your checkbook. So far as we know, the numbers are all showing that of course it does. So it's one of these things, why pay these men career science and all their health benefits to do something of which we obviously know the answer.
Are there new cracks forming? Can a new crack form?
That's why it's worth paying. Because maybe we haven't, we've only mentioned two ways these things can move. And Now, I think if you continue to think about that, this is the difference between Plato and Aristotle. Plato thought you could reach the truth by thinking. Aristotle thought you had to measure things. Well, there is, seems that you can actually move them alongside each other. And
couldn't one move up and one move down, too?
There you go.
Oh, that's the next.
Yeah. So we have four motions. Pretty hard to imagine in a three-dimensional world any more than those four basic ones. They can be at different angles, slightly pulling apart, you know, more up here than here, and so forth. But it turns out that with regard to the Earth, there is very little evidence of much up or down. And this is the amazing thing, that prior to the recognition that there were plates, and that they were moving apart in place and coming together, the general notion was that most of the motions in the Earth that explained the rocks was up and down. And that we'll go back to that, but we want to stay on track and get through this in a reasonable amount of time. So I've shown the three motions. I won't take time to tell you that I watched the Letterman show when Schwarzenegger was elected, and he said he just got a recent report from NASA. NASA always keeps in touch with him, and he showed this road map of California, and he showed the left side of it moving on San Andreas. We call these breaks faults, which is moving out to the west, and he showed that part of California out in the Pacific, and he said, now we have evidence that that part of California has left the United States. Okay, this is now almost the end of the story, but maybe we should, Paul Harvey would say, now for the rest of the story. Let's start at Holden Village, and we're on the peak of one of these mountains out here. Ben has been coming here for 60 years?
No.
50 years.
Since 65.
Boy, well, close to half a century. I mean, there's a lot of geological processes that are pretty fantastic, and even in a short time of 50 years. These plates are moving at about the rate that your thumbnail grows, pulling apart. But there's another thing that happens in the Earth that we haven't talked about, and that is the inexorable work of the force of gravity, that everything wants to fall toward the center of the Earth. And so these peaks are, they are under the force of gravity. The air, the heaven, you know, weighs 14 and a half pounds per square inch on your station. You should always be, in a way, mindful of the heavens, because they're actually pressing it down. This air going up in the surrounding Earth weighs 14 and a half pounds per square inch. That's weighing down. But in addition, going back to the water is circulating on the Earth. At the equator, it's getting heated, vaporizes, moves up, comes down as rain, runs down, and we also have freezing. And when things freeze, the ice expands, and not only milk bottles crack, but the tops of these mountains crack. And then we have another phenomenon, and that's the chemical reaction of air on liquids and solids. And one of the big concerns here at Holden is the chemical reaction of air combining with the sulfur coming out of these tailings and reacting with things in the biological world. Well, that's happening here, and it is breaking down the rock, and we call that weathering. And there's a whole field of geology studying the rate at which weathering occurs. Then the weathered material under the force of gravity, gets transported to some, geologists call it the baseline, and I want to ask, what is the baseline? The baseline is the ocean. That's as far as liquid can carry materials, down to here, the Pacific, and the Gulf of Mexico, and the Atlantic. And there are shorelines in the oceanic basins, and the material that's being carried as particles and as dissolved chemical species falls out. And the faster the water is moving, the bigger the material, the larger the material it can carry. And you're probably all aware of the fact that here in Washington, you have not only worldwide class phenomenon, but in the solar system. Thus far, the evidence for the movement of the largest objects called haystacks here by simply moving water that when a ice dam broke around Missoula, Montana. So you can move things downward, but when the velocity of the water slows, particles settle out. So while those haystacks were left here on land, sand was being carried by the Columbia River out to the shoreline. And so we get layered rocks produced by sand falling out, and we call those sandstones. Finer material, which is usually black, we call mud. And the rock forming from it we call shale, and that is found further out because it's smaller, can be carried further. And further out from the coast, you have the chemical species. One of the major ones is the element calcium, combines with carbon dioxide dissolved in the water and crystallizes a mineral called calcite, which forms a rock called limestone. So we get layers. In Minnesota, we see beautiful layers in the river cuts of sandstone, shale, and limestone. And interesting thing, sometimes we find the limestone on top of the sandstone. Well, that means that somehow the water went up and the beach went back, or the water went down and the beach went out. So we get a change in vertical succession. So there's a whole world of geologists studying these materials that are broken up material. Now, there was a famous Scottish geologist who had his career at Columbia University, and he had to teach a course in sedimentary rocks. If we now bury them, we change them, and we call those metamorphic rocks. We bury them deep enough, they melt, and they come back up as igneous rocks. The metamorphic rocks and the igneous rocks have crystals in them that are related to the growth produced by the increase in temperature and pressure as those sediments are carried down. So this gentleman, Shan, he had to teach beginning geologists about all three of these rock types, and he said, we're not going to spend much time on the sedimentary rocks because they are to the crystalline, metamorphic, and igneous rocks as sawdust is to the living tree. And people who are studying the sediments would say sort of the reverse. We can only understand these rocks you think are so interesting after nature takes them all apart into their individual particles. We bury these and we can convert a rock that has one mineral, calcium carbonate. It will usually have a little iron in it and stains it to kind of a buff color, so most limestones have a buff color. If you bury them, all that happens to them is that the calcite recrystallizes, much like taking dirty ice, melting it, refreezing it, and you get clean ice, because as the new ice forms, the the dirty materials segregated out. And you get a beautiful rock that Michelangelo used in Italy, the Carrar marble. And in the Rockies, you'll find beautiful samples of marble in a place in Colorado appropriately called Marble, where the Unknown Soldier Monument in Arlington Cemetery is carved from that block. If you bury the muds, they are very complicated. They have almost all the chemistry and low temperature forms of the minerals of the original igneous rocks, minus a little calcium and minus a little silica. If you recrystallize those, you get a series of rocks that are barely recrystallized, and we call those as a leaf-like or phyllites. And if you crystallize them a little further, the individual layers, which were once sedimentary, you get minerals poking out of them that are growing, and it's called a schist. And if you heat them up further, those minerals reform sufficiently so the rock will look like a granite, which is a crystalline igneous rock, except that it will usually carry the layering of the original sedimentary rock. That is called a gneiss. Now, there, you have a similar thing. Again, you younger people didn't have to bring in coal from the coal shed into the house. If you bury plants, you can produce peat, lignite, soft coal, hard coal, and then graphite. And that transition is related to heat and pressure and driving off water. If you take the material deep enough, the graphite, which is just pure carbon and has a crystal structure, that the carbon atoms are aligned in layers, and so graphite is very soft. And pencils, called lead pencils, are filled with graphite, and then you rub that off on the paper. If you bury it deep enough, 100 miles deep in the earth, you will transform it not chemically, but structurally, and the carbon atoms rearrange and form the hardest natural mineral, diamond. So you can go from a plant to a diamond with pressure, and we've learned in the laboratory actually how to do that, make a diamond. Very small, but you can make them. So the transition from, did I mention that the equivalent of a granite in a metamorphic rock is gneiss? So slate, I said phyllite, left out slate. Slate, schist, gneiss. And if you completely remelt it, you'll get a magma. And the magma now will come up because it is less dense and will form a new volcano. So that's geology in a nutshell. And so I take time to actually tell you that in 1958, when I first started geology, this cycle from sedimentary rocks, metamorphic rocks, to igneous rocks is called the rock cycle. And geologists had a completely plausible grand theory of how these rock transitions occur and why we have the rocks. And it was all based on that you bring things down, put them on a beach, they have weight, so you don't have to worry about the fact that you can get something 10, 11,000 feet thick, because you simply press down the thing you're putting it in, and when they melt the material, it's going to push everything back up. So they had an explanation for the fact that you find fossils that had to live in the ocean at elevations of 10,000 feet or so. It was called the geosynclinal theory. It was great, but it was like the Ptolemaic theory of in astronomy. It was wrong until we learned about these horizontal motions. While I've left out mineralogy, I've left out what the magnetic field of the Earth tells us. I've only alluded a little bit to gravity, but this grand theory is now called plate tectonics, and now we've been asking such interesting questions of when did these plates first form, and as was asked, are new ones forming? And the question is, we don't know when it started, and new ones are forming. There's a little block outside Seattle called the Juan de Fuca Plate, and there are motions on that. It's part of the motion going that way, it's part of the motion of the plates coming in. Very complicated motion that has led to the geology of the last 100 million years in this area. So why don't we leave it there? Get a good night's sleep. Now if you're in Hawaii, you'd have to be worried about is that molten material going to come up? In Iceland, same thing. Here we can. Yes.
I just want to give a future advertisement, advertisement for your speech or talk on meteorites. Because if you really want to have something to worry about, come and hear that.
Well, with regard to, that's the problem with inviting a geologist, you know, hard time shutting him up. But I said I could talk about different things, and he ended up assigning me these different slots. Tomorrow, we're scheduled to look at the geology around here, and the ideal place to do that is up at the new museum, where you can actually see the geology. And so I think they will announce at the breakfast tomorrow morning how we're going to arrange that. I think the simple thing would be that a lot of people, you can walk up there, a nice refreshing walk.
Steve.
And I think it's scheduled for 11:50, or is it 12? Some could walk, and then the van can take people up 4 or 6 at a time. Any questions? Yes, go ahead.
If I may, just a stray question. I've read that Mount Stewart is a mountain that's floated up from Central America. Is that true or false?
Well, yeah, that's another thing I didn't touch on, because you see, once you've got the basic fact that these plates are moving, and we don't know the current ones we see, what was it like in the past? And this is where the Earth's magnetic field comes in, that you can, in these rocks around this fireplace, the iron in them, in iron oxides, if that's above 600 degrees centigrade, they will orient their magnetic orientation of the atoms in the direction of the Earth's field. And when it goes below that, it's locked in. Now, if that rock has not moved, then you can use it to tell how the Earth's field has changed. But if the rock has moved and the Earth's field hasn't changed, then you can tell where the rock has moved. And these are called polar magnetic wandering paths. Now, you have to know another thing in order to be able to, you have to know the age of the rock. And then you have to look at it worldwide. And the result of all of that study has shown that there were smaller plates, and they have moved about. And John McPhee has written a couple of books suspect terrain, about these terrains and how they have moved together. Minnesota, we have a mass of rock in northern Minnesota that's pretty much like India and the Indian Ocean. Southern part of the state, we have rocks like the Himalayas. And in the ones in the southern part of the state are 3.5 billion years old. The ones in the north are 2.7. There's a big belt of rocks that are 2 billion in between. And the earthquake data shows us that the northern rocks have gone under the rocks to the south. It's just like the Himalayas, only 180 degrees reversed. So in this little block of the Earth's crust in Minnesota, we have evidence of the motion of plates relative to each other. So that's the intriguing thing about it. Now, I don't find any conflict at all with Genesis, because it says the land appeared. It doesn't say anything about what happened after the land appeared.
How accurate are some of these earthquake prediction theories?
Some people are saying they're more accurate than weather predictions. Weather predictions are getting pretty accurate overall. The earthquake predictions, I wish I had brought a stick so I could bend it and show you the difference. If you take a nice thin piece of, say, oak, and you bend it slowly, you know, it'll snap a little bit and splinter a little bit, and it will never really break. You can actually fold it and little splinters will bend over. But if you put it on the edge and you hit it with a whack, you can crack it right off. So with regard to rock motion, they found that if you get a little steam coming out of Mount Baker, probably a good thing, because some adjustments are occurring there. But whether that's range of relieve the stress enough. They actually thought maybe they could prevent earthquakes by pumping water. They did this in Colorado, pumping water down a break that they call a fault. They thought if you lubricate it, it would move it a little, move it in steps. Unfortunately, it moved it in a big step. They found, fortunately found out early enough, that's not a good idea.
Did you do that recently?
I think that's about 10, 15 years ago. You didn't hear a lot about it.
No, I didn't.
No. It would be a big, wide goal.
Well, no, it wasn't. You know, it was, they discovered what they've done mainly from looking at the earthquake data.
Okay.
So people that felt the earthquakes, like you do, Joel was telling me that, you know, it's a common experience in Seattle. Feel something shape.
So why are there continents and oceans? What's the relation? Is it because of the plates?
That they're thin. And the rocks of the ocean floor have a density of about three times that of water. Mm. The rocks that we see here have about the density about 2.7, so they're less dense, and so naturally they can get thicker here to have the same weight, and that's another thing that we haven't touched on, that derives from when you know about the plates, then you begin to ask those questions, and you can. The reason it's thinner is that that's in what we call isostatic adjustment. The pressures to the center of the Earth are satisfied with about 7 miles of basalt, but on the continents where you have granites, you have to have about 40 miles, so that the two are under the same pressure regime and not moving relative to each other.
The Earth makes that adjustment?
Yes, it adjusts to it. And the, when the, when you take the material down, and if you take ocean floor down, you've got a thin slab. When you have the continent of India, now you've closed the ocean, there's a problem, you know, because that the rocks of India is about the same density as Asia, and they're pressing together, they're not going to go down. It'll break somewhere else where it's thinner and go down. So that would add to the growth of the continents through time. And this is another area that you could ask yourself, if the plates were very small, not the plates were small, but the amount of continental material was small. If the whole Earth was all covered with a shell of basalt, very uniformly, and then it broke, a new basalt came up, and then we got granitic rocks, the continents would grow with time. So you could ask, have they grown uniformly with time? Are they growing faster now than they did in the past? Or did they grow very fast to begin with? And this is the percent of the present continental crust that we have. And you may not remember, Katie, this is why we went to England in the 1980s. This was the debate. And the data seems to suggest that pretty much the size of the continents, two-thirds, one-third of the Earth, was pretty much complete by about 2 billion years. And since then, we've gotten rid of as much as we've produced. But again, it's an example of the evolution of the continents, that the land has grown with time.
Then the question about how the continents have shifted in the globe over time too is one I don't quite
constant, understand. Well, constant debate, and there are certain groups that have come up with a complete solution, and then people begin checking it and they find it. In the case of North America, Minnesota, at about 300 million years ago, was over the equator. And we have the rocks and the fossils that mm-hmm. document that. And it has moved to its present position since then.
So you were saying prior to that, that Minnesota was also made up of different rocks from India, from...
They were different fragments.
Elsewhere.
Different
that
fragments
mixed
of
together.
Oceanic and continental crust. Uh-huh. And so there are only about five places in the world, and they're in the center of continents that you have a record of this ancient terrain. Now, Katie mentioned the lecture on meteorites. What I think I'll focus on there is that you look up at the moon at night and you see these dark areas. Those are places where the moon, smaller, solidified from it's being hit by earthquakes, so it rings like a bell. So you have equivalent things to our earthquake data. Shows no evidence of a center in the stip, so it's all solid. And the meteorites striking it created craters, and there was still molten material a little bit left, and it oozed into those craters and formed what Galileo calls seas, because they're flat. And if that happened on the moon, then it certainly must have happened on Earth. So we have in Minnesota evidence of material being thrown out from Canada, sort of the reverse of our throwing all our automobile, new cars and everything across the border. They were throwing rocks at us 2 billion years ago, landing in Minnesota. And so that's the second oldest event, 2 billion years. But the main cratering on the moon is between 4.5 and 2 billion. So there's got to be some record in the old rocks. Well, going away, I gave you this beautiful blue sheet. The old geologist talked about the rock cycle. I think one should more properly think of it as a helix. Every time you go around from an active volcano to sedimentary rocks to metamorphic rocks to a new volcano, that is in time, and all the geologic periods are defined by those cycles. And so this is a thing that you can find on the USGS webpage of trying to summarize the history of the evolution of life and the geologic record and the succession of events. And it all goes back to a point which was dealt with in the lecture on the Shark Cathedral, trying to find that center point of rest when things weren't really stirring about. Well, I'll leave these books out here. And we'll see what we can arrange for tomorrow.
Thank you.